Who are those masked men in Crimea? Today, Thursday, February 27th, this is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Ukraine reels from a fast-moving crisis. Today, new questions about who exactly is raising the Russian flag in Crimea. And historian Anne Applebaum says there are other big challenges facing Ukraine's interim leaders.
Massive amounts of money have been stolen literally out of the state coffers. They have potential separatist movements, unrest of all kinds.
Also, investigative journalists celebrate finding a massive trove of documents at the abandoned presidential palace in Kiev.
We've been working for many years investigating, but we had information that can count as a drop in an ocean. And now we have ocean.
Plus, how to track a man-eating tiger in northern India.
You know, you've got to think like a tiger. That's the only way you can get it.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Washington, D.C.-based Unity Healthcare. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Another unexpected turn in Ukraine's crisis today. Masked gunmen stormed government buildings in the country's Crimea region. They've barricaded themselves inside and raised the flag of Russia over the Crimean parliament. It's an ominous development, potentially the start of a struggle that could split Ukraine in two. On one side, the country's new interim leaders and the protesters in Kiev who ousted President Viktor Yanukovych. On the other, those opposed to the change, and Russia, which backs Yanukovych's claims that he is still Ukraine's legitimate president. Columnist Anne Applebaum has watched this region for decades. She's the author of Iron Curtain, The Crushing of Eastern Europe. And Applebaum says the masked gunmen in Crimea did not appear spontaneously.
Look, this is clearly a pre-planned action. When Yanukovych left Kiev, it's pretty clear that the idea was to move on to Plan B, and Plan B is to create some kind of separatist movement in Crimea and perhaps in eastern Ukraine. You know, the masked men who moved into the parliament this morning were clearly prepared to do so. They were, you know, they were wearing unmarked uniforms. They knew what they were doing. They had a plan. The question now is how it will affect Ukrainians both in Crimea and outside the country. I mean, there doesn't seem to be a lot of energy in Ukraine for a civil war or for any kind of violent separatist movement. I mean, there's never been any indication that there would be such a thing or that people wanted that. But the game may be simply to destabilize the situation, you know, to create, you know, an ungovernable space in Crimea, to upset the new government, to create a problem that the new government won't be able to solve and will distract it from actually its more important tasks, which are to put the economy back right again.
I want to go back to the idea that all of this in the last couple of days and the flight of Yanukovych was pre-planned. What is the evidence that all of this was engineered, and how much do you believe of it happened in Moscow?
Yanukovych's behavior was very, very peculiar. He signed a treaty with, you know, in the presence of foreign ministers from the EU, which talked about holding early elections in December. It spoke about the creation of a national unity government. There was no indication in it that he had to leave or was being forced out of the country. And what he did was, literally, as the EU ministers were still sitting in the building, he left the room, he left the city, and he told all the security guards to leave all government buildings. Somebody gave an order for them to do that. What was the purpose of that? Perhaps there was the idea that maybe the protesters would come in and ransack the building, and then he could claim he'd been ousted in a violent coup d'etat. It's clear that he didn't intend ever to fulfill the terms of the agreement. You know, he wasn't negotiating in good faith. He always intended to leave.
And now Russia is offering protection for him. But put us in the Kremlin's shoes for a moment. How do they see what's happened in Ukraine? And what do they want from all of this?
You know, I think for the Russians, this is a great foreign policy failure. Their original idea was that Yanukovych would somehow drive Ukraine into a kind of locked embrace with Russia, that Ukraine would become part of a customs union run by Russia. And they seem to have decided, right, that's not going to work. You know, we need another plan. Perhaps the plan is to cut off a part of Ukraine and absorb it into Russia as fast as possible. Perhaps the plan is simply to destabilize the new Ukrainian government so that people will once again become disillusioned with this pro-European mood in Kiev, and they'll vote for something else. But, you know, I think the bottom line is that what Russia does not want is a kind of prosperous, democratic, and pro-Western Ukraine.
Why not?
Because that's too much of a rebuke to Putin and his system. I don't even think this is really a foreign policy issue. This is about Russian domestic politics. If the Ukrainians can have a democracy and can be oriented towards the West, well, why can't Russia? And the fact is that Putin doesn't want that to happen because that would then threaten his own personal power. What's happened in Ukraine over the last, 10 days is really his worst nightmare, that there's a popular uprising and, the people come in and ransack the oligarchs' palaces and find out how much money they've been spending.
I mean, you spent a lot of time in this part of the world, Anne Applebaum. Are you, from what you know, is there reason to be hopeful about Ukraine's future?
Ukrainians themselves give me some hope about the future. This is a very educated country. They use the same kind of language that Central Europeans used 20 years ago, which is we want a normal political system. We don't want mass theft. We don't want corruption. I think there is a pretty deep and broad understanding of where they want to go. And, where they want to go is Europe. They want, not necessarily to be members of the EU. It's not exactly about that, but they have an idea of what a good and prosperous society looks like, and that's what they want.
I just want to circle back before we let you go, Anne, and ask you a quick question about the stuff that's happening in Crimea today. Do you have any reason to believe that these masked men armed are more than just Ukrainians who are Russian nationalists?
They may well not be real nationalists, if that's what you're asking me, a real separatist. Is it conceivable that they are a group of people organized by the Russian government, from their bases in Sebastopol? Yes, it's possible. Their timing and their organization is suspicious.
Anne Applebaum is a columnist with The Washington Post and Slate. Her most recent book is Iron Curtain, The Crushing of Eastern Europe, 1944 to 1956. Anne, great to speak with you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Reporter Charles Maines is in Moscow. So, Charles, what's the view from there? Do you agree with Anne Applebaum that the timing and organization of these masked men in Crimea appear suspicious?
Well, certainly there's a lot of interest in how this all unfolded today. There's been so much activity, beginning with early this morning with these gunmen taking over the parliament in Simferopol. But the big news also here from Moscow is, of course, Yanukovych is surfacing.
Right.
Suddenly we get news on the Russian wire service that he announces he's still the legitimate president, still the head of the armed forces, and demanding a return to this political settlement that was brokered before his ouster. And then half an hour later, there's another strangely issued statement to the effect that Russia has agreed to guarantee his personal safety in Russia. And then the day ends, in fact, with Yanukovych announcing he's going to hold a press conference tomorrow at 5 p.m. in Rostov-on-Don, which is near the Ukrainian border in southern Russia.
Right, but it is in Russia. So Yanukovych is presumably in Russia right now, is that right?
Well, there have been rumors that he's been spotted in Moscow and various places outside of Moscow, but none of this is confirmed. But apparently he'll be showing up in Rostov tomorrow. Where he is exactly right now, I couldn't say.
And what about Anne Applebaum's narrative as far as how Viktor Yanukovych left Ukraine, that this was kind of all engineered and planned in advance? Does that fit with what you're hearing in Moscow?
Well, I don't know. I think, it's strange because if you look at the way state media has portrayed Yanukovych, they've certainly kind of made him look like a very ineffectual leader, not in the sense that he's corrupt in any way. And I think that sense Applebaum is right. But on the other hand, they've pointed out that he essentially abandoned his duties. He didn't stay it out and stick it out like a president should. So, I think the narrative you've seen sort of from everyone from state media to the prime minister, Dmitry Medvedev, pointing out that, in fact, Yanukovych is very weak, and it's, I think, probably a bad sign when Dmitry Medvedev tells you that you're a weak leader.
So this is how the whole story is kind of being presented in the Russian media?
It is, or it has been up until today. Suddenly I think they've made this shift. And, I think as you look at what's happening here, you have to ask, why now? Why would Yanukovych suddenly assert himself as a real leader? He's disappeared for 6 days, and suddenly he shows up saying probably what he should have said at the beginning if he really wanted to make a claim here. And in terms of why the Kremlin might need Yanukovych, one theory is that this gives Putin some time and some options to consider what to do about Ukraine and Crimea in particular.
And what's the popular mood about all this Ukraine business in Moscow?
Well, it depends on who you talk to. I think, certainly among the opposition movement here, which is not the majority, I don't think, they look at the events in Maidan and in Kiev as very inspiring and giving off sort of a chance to sort of reinvigorate the protest movement here. But I think for most Russians, they're, you know, the, certainly the way it's being played up in state media, and that's an effective message there, is that Russian-speaking populations are under threat in Ukraine. And certainly the authorities in Kiev didn't do themselves any favor by essentially outlawing a law that made Russian a sort of a co-language, co-national language in Ukraine. So I think a lot of people feel that, that it seems to be drifting towards that direction where the message is that we need to do something to save these Russian-speaking populations.
Reporter Charles Maines in Moscow, thank you so much.
Thank you, Marco.
When Yanukovych fled Kiev, one of the things we learned was that he had a private dining hall in the shape of a pirate ship, which is kind of weird but also interesting, and I'll tell you why. You see, writer Alina Simone was born in what's now Russian-speaking Ukraine, and when she's feeling a little nostalgic, she heads to Gambrinus, a Russian restaurant that's also got a pirate theme. It's in Brighton Beach, Brooklyn, a neighborhood where you hear lots of Russian.
About twice a year, I hit Brighton Beach, usually with another Russian friend. We grab some comfort food, enjoy the sight of women wearing leopard print unironically, and make sure to pick up some really bad vodka in a Kalashnikov-shaped bottle. A lot of us Russian-born Americans have a love-hate relationship with Brighton. It's a time capsule that manages to combine both the reassuringly familiar and the super uncool aspects of our Cold War youths.
It's the same. People are not changing that much, you know?
That's Ina Litus. She's been working as a cook at Gambrinus for 2 years, but has lived above the restaurant for almost 10.
Russians live on Brighton Beach, and they will live on Brighton Beach. So I cannot say that it's changed. Nothing changed, actually.
Even the names don't change. Ina is also my mother's name. Tonight, I'm not accompanied by my usual Russian nostalgia seekers, but a group of Americans. Our table includes a three-year-old, a female sword swallower, and two vegans. I'm mostly worried about the vegans. As my Russian grandmother used to say, if it isn't meat, it isn't food. I shouldn't have worried. The plate of pickled vegetables our waitress puts in front of them looks like a page torn from a food magazine. And I seriously want to faceplant right into their bowl of fried potatoes. Despite the tourist trapping pirate statues and fishing nets, Gambrinus is still very much a local hangout. A fixture on the boardwalk scene for over 20 years now. As our waitress, Svetlana Castro, explains, people love this restaurant. Some customers come here up to 5 times a week. Not every restaurant can claim that. Around 50% are regular customers. To sit here in the summer, peel some raw shrimp, have some beer outside by the ocean after the beach. It's hard to imagine Brighton Beach without that idyllic shrimp-eating scene, but Hurricane Sandy shut all the boardwalk restaurants down for a month or more. On the other side of Brooklyn, my husband and I spent the storm bored at home, binging on Arrested Development. Out here, Gambrinus was flooding, and Ina was in serious cat rescue mode.
I cared about my cats that I have at home, so... Like, I was swimming. I was coming home because we got stuck in a car with my brother on Neptune Avenue, so I was swimming to get home. It was crazy.
I feel like there's a metaphor here somewhere. This is where my friends and I come to remember our fresh-off-the-boat roots, to laugh and to drink and celebrate our lost accents. But when the storm hits, we're sure to be someplace else, someplace safe. It turns out I'm only the latest in a line of Brighton Beach nostalgia seekers. You could even call nostalgia seeking a long-standing tradition here. The owners of this restaurant opened it in homage to the same restaurant in Odessa. It seems like they really missed it and decided to make another one, another seafood beer hall. The original Gambrinus looks just like this one, Svetlana told me. Dark wood, pirates, and lots of beer. And after 130 years, I'm happy to learn, it's still there. For the World, this is Alina Simone, Brighton Beach, Brooklyn.
You can get a taste of the pirate theme at Gambrinus. We've got photos at PRI.org. Stick around. Later, we're going to pop in at the world's largest Cinnabon in Tripoli, Libya, on PRI Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Washington, D.C.-based Unity Healthcare. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Venezuela's government is facing some of its biggest protests in years. The unrest began earlier this month because of anger over food shortages, rising prices, and high crime. President Nicolas Maduro has responded by cracking down on the protests. The resulting violence has left at least 13 people dead, all of which has Venezuelans at home and abroad worried and turning to new ways to communicate. The World's Monica Campbell explains.
Right now, in Venezuela, this is how some people are staying connected. A man says he's heard about a woman who's been injured at a protest. Is it true, he asks? Yes, there's a woman on the ground, another man says. They say there's been a shooting. This walkie-talkie conversation is happening over a smartphone app called Zello, made in Austin, Texas. It was big during Ukraine's unrest. Now it's popular in Venezuela. Unlike Facebook or Twitter, Zello lets people talk without revealing their location or identity, important for protesters. But this free flow of information is hitting obstacles. Last week, there were unexplained internet shutdowns in Venezuela, and the state-owned internet provider has tried blocking Zello. President Nicolas Maduro says he's not behind any of this, but he does say that it's the government's job to protect Venezuelans from, quote, war propaganda, coup mongers, and people provoking, quote, public anxiety. A new law makes it easier to jail people for crossing these blurry lines. But it's not just people in Venezuela trying to test new and perhaps safer lines of communication. Venezuelans abroad are doing that too.
Okay, my name is Sandra Jaimez, and I work in San Jose, California. I'm the only member of my family here in the United States. Everybody else is in Venezuela.
Jaimez is from the city of San Cristobal, where the unrest began. She says she can't get a clear idea of what's really happening at home. She can't trust the state-controlled media, and the opposition is spreading plenty of false information too. So she's glued to her phone and the WhatsApp mobile messaging service.
It became very popular, especially after this whole thing started.
She's now in a closed WhatsApp group with 50 relatives in constant touch.
And I can show you, this is my family, shooting pictures and sending them to me and asking me to please publish them in Facebook or any kind of media that I can. Sometimes they don't do it because they're afraid.
She also sees how the app is making daily life there a little easier.
Right now, it's like a survivor tool. We know where everybody is, if everybody got safe, even, you know, basic things. If someone has milk or water or this. Also, they are taking turns to watch the streets at night, and they inform the neighbors when they see something coming, when they hear a noise.
And in Venezuela, there's a collective of programmers determined to keep these mobile apps and networks thriving. Over Skype, I speak with one young hacker and activist.
I belong to the open source movement, and this is part of my culture, you know, of having free community and a free internet. A typical day for me has been getting infrastructure ready for more people to use, proxies, using network tools to check censorship.
And he knows it's a risky time to do this. He asks me not to use his name.
I'm not at home. I'm staying in friend's house. So I'm moving locations all the time. I wonder why I'm doing this. But the thing is that I remind myself that I'm a Venezuelan citizen and I deserve to be treated like one.
When I ask him what he thinks will happen in Venezuela, he says he's not sure. But he says his role right now is to let people have the freedom to protest, debate, and have a say in what comes next. For The World, I'm Monica Campbell.
It's been a while since we've done a geoquiz, but don't despair. We have a new one for you right now. Ready? Because it's going to be a quick one. We're searching for a place in northern India. Authorities there are scrambling to try and find a man-eating tiger. So far, it's killed 10 people. Most were farmers working in the sugarcane fields. The deaths have taken place close to the oldest national park in India. It sits in the foothills of the Himalayas and is home to perhaps 10% of India's estimated 1,700 wild tigers. So, can you name that national park? Here's one more clue. It's named after a top colonial-era tiger hunter. Okay, time's up. The answer is Jim Corbett National Park. Authorities in India actually think the man-eating tiger they're hunting is from the park. They also suspect it's a tigress. But more than 6 weeks since it first struck, they're still no closer to catching the rogue animal. The BBC's Andrew North has been out with one of the hunting teams.
Wherever it is, it's going to kill. That's the risk.
Hunter Ashish Dasgupta and his team are in their element on the trail of India's latest man-eating tiger.
This is the conflict zone. And you have miles and miles of sugarcane fields. People are cutting the sugarcane now. And the tiger can come out from anywhere, pick a person up and disappear inside. And you can't follow it in.
Dasgupta is a veteran of more than 40 hunts for tigers or leopards that have turned man-eater. 6 weeks since its first kill, this tiger is proving hard to find.
It's so elusive that it's not leaving very many traces. We are collecting a lot of circumstantial evidences. It's not able to bite into the flesh effectively. It's going for soft parts, which makes me question whether it's able to use its jaws. Is it wounded?
The tiger has often been hiding inside dense fields of sugarcane, like the one I'm walking through now. Many of the stems reach over 2 meters high. And even a short distance inside the field, it's impossible to see anything until it's too late. In the village of Sahuwala, life is at a near standstill after the tiger's latest strike on a farmer minding his cattle. Vicky Singh was his grandson.
The cattle came back without him. We immediately started searching because we feared a tiger may have attacked him. Next morning, I found his red and yellow turban and then the remains of his body. I just collapsed.
So the hunters are now driving along a track through pretty dense bush and using a powerful searchlight.
Look. Two eyes glint from the darkness.
No, just a minute. It is...
A frightened animal runs across the riverbed.
Jackal. You know, you've got to think like a tiger. That's the only way you can get him.
Yeah. Next day, Ashish Dasgupta and his team have found a potential lead. Some tiger tracks.
We became aware of this tiger from the alarm calls given out by the cheetah deer.
Only when they've done plaster casts of the footprints will they be able to tell if this is the man-eater. But it's telling the tiger was just a short distance from where they were staying the night.
Forest land is depleted and the animals don't know where to go. So the chances of human conflict is very high. Even 10 years or 15 years back, forest cover was much, much bigger. You take somebody's home away, where is he going to be? On the streets. It becomes a hobo.
The BBC's Andrew North reporting near Jim Corbett National Park in northern India. This is PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead, how a group of poor, malnourished villagers in Kenya inspired singer Angelique Kidjo by singing her a song.
My heart started pounding out, like shivering to get out. And I just was drawn. I couldn't even help it. I was just drawn by the beauty and the strength that comes out of those voices.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Washington, D.C.-based Unity Healthcare. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. It's an investigative journalist dream, a trove of thousands of sensitive documents found in the wake of a toppled leader. That's what Ukrainian reporters discovered inside the hastily abandoned luxury compound of ousted President Viktor Yanukovych. For the past 5 days, a group of journalists has been going through all the documents, then scanning and uploading them to the internet. But there's a twist. Many of the documents were found floating or submerged in water, so salvaging the waterlogged papers has become the focus of this project, dubbed Yanukovych Leaks. Natalie Sedletsta is a journalist with Radio Liberty in Ukraine and one of the journalists working to save these documents.
So divers, they had an information that there is documents, folders just floating in the river. It's artificial reservoir called Kiev Sea here, and Mezhigirye is on the bank of it. So probably somebody was just trying to destroy papers and documents before leaving.
So Mezhigirye, that's the name of the estate of Yanukovych. So your job now, along with the other journalists, is to read these documents and figure out what might be incriminating. But the divers get them out of this lake, this Kiev lake. They're soaking wet. They could easily disintegrate. How did you physically save them?
So we decided that we are coming together with a team of investigative journalists from different media outlets and just staying here, trying to put all our connections to try to rescue these documents. So we called people from libraries. And people from library brought us special heaters for these documents. And it was like that. The journalist has to take the folder and put on each wet page one separate piece of dry paper and do it with every single page from the wet folder. But while he was doing it, he had to take a picture of it right away. So if somebody will come and take these documents, we at least had some pictures. After that, we decided that it's time already to put these documents into sauna, because in this house where we were staying, there was a sauna.
A sauna bath.
And yes. Wow. So they're in sauna now. And we created a website called Yanukovych Leaks. And now we are uploading folder by folder to this website.
I mean, from beginning to end, it sounds like a really sophisticated operation. How many journalists are taking part in this effort?
It's up to 15 journalists. But, you know, are there many interesting things are going on? For example, we've got access to an archive of other documents.
The other documents that were not in this lake?
Yes. Yanukovych's home is a huge, huge territory. And so we found an office and we came into this office and we saw the whole archive of documents. And from the beginning, we saw that those documents in the lake, there were most important, but now we found something more interesting even in these archives.
So, Natalie, what are some of the documents that you're suspicious about at this point that you've combed through?
You can divide documents in a few sections. One of them are something about big corruption. Some of them are just very funny, and some of them are like ridiculous, you know. We have found it here, incoming checks, 100,000 euros by unknown investor in cash. And we have like, I don't know, maybe 100, at least 100 these incoming checks. Of course, this is a bribe.
Well, it is hard to know what exactly it is, but it does seem like something of a smoking gun. What is the oddest letter or document that you found in this trove?
Oh, yeah. Last night we were sitting here in this office where we found a big archive of documents, and one of my colleagues were reading an internal investigation concerning the disappearance of kangaroo. And
kangaroo?
It was said in documents like kangaroo, yes.
Wow.
President Yanukovych had a kangaroo, but it disappeared.
Was this part of his notorious zoo?
Yes. Kangaroo was here, but it disappeared.
Natalie, you've been investigating corruption in Ukraine for some time now, so a lot of this might not be a surprise. But suddenly, to have all these documents before you and be in the presidential residence looking at them, what does this feel like?
First, I feel like it's a dream, but I haven't slept for a few days, so it's not a dream, definitely. Also, I feel satisfied, to be honest, because we were fighting for these documents, for every single document. We were filing requests, like where president lived, because he was hiding that he lives here on this huge territory. He was showing just small house. We were like fighting for this information for so long, and now we have it all. And we just want to show everything. So that's why we created a website. And I'm really looking forward to that moment when we will upload the last document and we will start to do our job. This is investigative journalism, and we will publish our investigative stories. I believe in that. That's why I'm so looking forward to come to this moment.
Natalie Sedletska, a journalist with Radio Liberty in Ukraine. She's part of the Yanukovych Leaks team, saving and publishing the documents left behind in the ousted Ukrainian president's house. Wild story, Natalie. Thanks for telling us.
Thank you, Marco.
We go now to Libya. It's Thursday night, the beginning of the weekend for folks in the Middle East. And in the capital city, the cafes are often packed, especially one particular spot, the Tripoli branch of Cinnabon. Yeah, that's right. It's billed as the largest Cinnabon franchise in the world. And reporter Maureen Olivezi is there. Describe the scene for us, Maureen. What's going on right now?
Well, it's early evening here, and the outlet is packed with customers. There's a big sitting area on the second floor. Right next to me, there's a party of 8 teenagers celebrating a birthday. But otherwise, it's mostly families with children and huge sticky rolls right in front of them. Thursday evening, as you said, it marks the beginning of the weekend, and some of these families say it's become a ritual for them to come here. One father said his 2 children actually request to come here at least once a week, because that's the only place where they can get a pecan and caramel roll.
So you visited the outlet earlier this week as well, and it seems that patrons were not just coming for the cinnamon rolls.
There are not a lot of places in Tripoli where young people can date. Libya is a conservative country. Young men and women socializing in public is largely frowned upon, unless maybe if they're at university. And most of the coffee houses in Tripoli are street level, which means you have a lot of traffic, and there's a good chance you'll run into a relative or a friend. I never see a lot of women there, and certainly don't often see couples on a date. So it seems like Cinnabon, at least when it's not as crowded as today, offers some sort of privacy that's rare here.
Now, I know in the mid-2000s, Libya was trying to get a little closer with U.S. businesses, but I hear that Cinnabon is actually now the first ever U.S. franchise to have opened in Libya. Of course, there was the Arab Spring. What took so long?
Well, Cinnabon was supposed to open before the revolution, actually, but there were delays because of Libya's erratic bureaucracy under Gaddafi's rule, and the store finally opened in July 2012, and it's been a hit so far. Like, the sales, according to the general manager, are about 3 times higher than the chain's global average, so that makes this store one of the most profitable Cinnabon branches in the world.
So, apart from Cinnabon, anything else new in Tripoli's dining scene?
Well, I've seen a lot of small food joints, actually, that weren't here last time I was in Tripoli in late 2012. There's that new burger and milkshake joint, for instance, that opened up just a few weeks ago. Zakaria, the owner, says he got the idea of the burger joint because he just couldn't find the type of burger he likes elsewhere. So for about 2 years, he and a friend worked and saved money. They teamed up with a business partner who had some savings, and they rented up a store, fixed it up, painted it, brought the equipment, and they're now serving quite a juicy burger, actually, with an amazing Oreo's milkshake to top it off.
An Oreo milkshake in Tripoli. Who knew?
Yes.
Could that have been possible before the revolution?
Well, I asked Zakaria, and he said, no, absolutely not. What's really surprising is actually the age of these 2 guys, Zakaria and Khaled. They're both 21, both in med schools. They're taking turns to manage the store while also pursuing their studies. And Zakaria said that's not something they could have done before. Listen to him.
The whole society didn't accept the idea of a bunch of young guys owning a business. It was possible after the revolution, because before the revolution, it wasn't really the system, but it was the people working at the system. They wouldn't take you seriously, they wouldn't accept any new ideas because they were kind of stuck in their own way of thinking. But after the revolution, a lot of that changed. And it seemed possible. It seemed like it can be done. So we went through it. And now it's here.
And, well, actually, now Zakaria says he just hopes that there won't be a McDonald's opening up soon in the neighborhood, because people would inevitably go there, not because their burgers taste better, he says, but just because it's McDonald's and young Libyans would be drawn to the brand name.
Yeah, who's ever heard that? Here's a McDonald's, there goes the neighborhood. Now, for me, the weird thing about Cinnabon is that it's always the first thing I see when I get out of an airplane at a U.S. airport. So they have plans for a Cinnabon at the Tripoli airport yet?
No, there are actually 2 other Cinnabons that have opened up over the past year. They're working on the 4th store, but not at the airport at that point. But they also mentioned that their plans to open a store in Benghazi, a flagship store in Benghazi. The only problem there is the area is much less stable than Western Libya, and there's some security concerns that they have to address before opening the store. Mostly the concern that an American franchise could be targeted by radical Islamists. But at this point, the general manager said he was still hoping that there could be a grand opening within a year.
Reporter Maureen Olivezi speaking with us from the Tripoli branch of Cinnabon. Never thought I'd say that, Maureen. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
The Academy Awards are on Sunday, and this year, for the first time ever, a film from Cambodia is being considered for an Oscar. The Missing Picture is nominated in the foreign film category. It explores the childhood memories of a man who lived through the brutal rule of the Khmer Rouge. That man is the film's director, as we hear from the world's Carol Hills.
Director Rithi Phan was 11 when the Khmer Rouge took over Cambodia in April 1975. He and his family lived in Phnom Penh, and like the entire population of Cambodia, they were forced into the countryside to work in labor camps. They worked 12-hour days cultivating rice, hauling rocks, building roads, with few breaks, little contact with one another, and most critically, barely any food. Over several years, Rithi watched as first his father, then his mother, his sisters, and his nephews died of starvation or exhaustion. Eventually, Rithi escaped to Thailand and then to France, where he stumbled upon filmmaking in a vocational school.
I think that I'm not here today because I'm stronger than other people. I have survived this genocide because other people helped me to survive.
Rithi Phan moved back to Cambodia in 1990 and has been making documentaries ever since. But The Missing Picture is his most personal. It's told in the first person, in Rithi Phan's own words. They're his memories, like this one, after the Khmer Rouge entered Phnom Penh and forced the entire population of 2.5 million people into the Cambodian countryside by train, by wagon, and by foot.
Suddenly, there are no individuals, only numbers. They cut our hair. They take our watches, glasses, toys, books. They dye our clothes black. They change our first names. We are the new people, bourgeois, intellectuals, and capitalists, to be eradicated, to be destroyed.
The Missing Picture is a stylistic and atmospheric film. It forces you to watch as people, including children, work to exhaustion and die. But they're not actors and actresses.
I did not find a way to make a film about genocide with actor or actress, you know, like Steven Spielberg did it in the Schindler List, for example.
Rithi says he lived through this genocide, so it's very difficult for him to show actors how to portray it. How to die.
To ask them how to die, to explain them how to execute people, it's hard for me.
Instead, he used clay figurines to represent the people in the camps, including himself.
When I make the choice of using the clay figurine, it's come by accident, you know.
Rithi Phan had started a traditional film using actors, and then one day his assistant took some clay from the river and sculpted a small boy that resembled Rithi when he was 13.
It's a very expressive, very powerful and very poetic at the same time.
He's right. The static clay figurines are surprisingly moving. They have expressions, usually dull and emotionless, but strangely, you care about them when they suffer, and they suffer a lot in this film. They're part of elaborate dioramas Rithi Phan created using cardboard, bits of wood, plastic, and iron wire. There are sound effects like a real movie, and the ever-present narrator speaking for Rithi.
Walking in the water is torture. I collapse from exhaustion.
The Missing Picture also uses Khmer Rouge propaganda films. In one scene, you see a diorama of clay figurines being forced to watch one of them. On the little movie screen made for the diorama, you see the real film. It's Rithi Phan's way of showing what the Khmer Rouge wanted people to see, but also the way people there actually felt, emotionless, weak, and static, like the clay figurines. All the clay figures in the film wear the drab black clothing forced on them by the Khmer Rouge, except Rithi. His figurine is always wearing colorful clothes. He says when he was living under the Khmer Rouge, he kept himself alive by imagining he was wearing a colorful shirt.
Nobody can destroy your heart. Nobody can destroy your imagination, your spirit. Maybe they can destroy my body. They can kill my parent, but they cannot kill my soul.
The Missing Picture is part of Rithi Phan's lifelong quest to reconstruct Cambodia's cultural identity. He's created a center to preserve Cambodia's film, photographic, and audio history, which the Khmer Rouge destroyed. Rithi Phan will be in Los Angeles Sunday night at the Oscars. The Missing Picture opens in the U.S. on March 19th. For The World, I'm Carol Hills.
You can see those clay figurines in a clip from The Missing Picture, plus an interview with director Rithi Phan. That's all at PRI.org. This is PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention and dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. If you follow world music, you know Angélique Kidjo. She's a singer and activist from the West African nation of Benin. She's also a friend of our show. And full disclosure here, my mother did some translation work for Angélique's new book. It's a memoir titled Spirit Rising, My Life, My Music. Angélique Kidjo also has a new album called Eve. Angélique Kidjo, it's always so great to see you. I'd like us to focus on just a couple of songs from the new album, Eve. This first one is called Mbamba, and it's important to talk about because my understanding of how it happened kind of triggered a lot of collaborations on this whole album. So how did it all start?
Well, it all started, I think, a year and a half ago when the new head of UNICEF was really worried about the consequences of stunting. Stunting is acute malnutrition of a newborn baby. From the conception of the child till the child turned two, before those 2 years, we still have, if we treat the child early enough, we can transform that. And I went to Kenya with UNICEF. So I arrived in the Samburu district, and we had to visit two villages. And the first village we arrived in, it was emotionally drenching.
Why?
Because there was a child of 18 months that couldn't sit by himself, couldn't hold his head straight, could barely cry. He was like,
That's how malnourished he was.
Oh, my. I was like, oh, my God, this is too bad. And the mother was pregnant, 5 months pregnant, and stunted, too. And then I was a little bit mad because I was just like, this cannot continue like that. We got to fix some problem. We got to do it fast. And we left from that village and go to the second one. I was like, not knowing if I have to cry, what I have to do. It's just like as a mother, I was sore. My soul was sore, and I was a little bit lost, and it fuzzy a little bit. And I walk into the second village, and it was completely different. I mean, different everything. They were welcoming with that song. As my head was fuzzy, and my whole body was aching from the pain of the first visit, and they start singing that song, and I start having chill down my back. And my heart started pounding out, like shivering to get out. I mean, I just was drawn. I couldn't even help it. I did not think. I was not in the mood of thinking about my album. I was not thinking about any of that. I was just drawn by the beauty and the strength that comes out of those voices. And I'm like, this is what it is really in Africa. You can have a very, very challenging and very emotional moment. And at the same time, the other coin, side of the coin, it's just bright.
Your husband, Jean Ebraille, I gathered, recorded this on a smartphone or some recording device, and that became sort of the scratch source composition for Mbamba.
Absolutely, because he saw me, he knows so well, he saw me grappling with where I was before. And he's always on the back, never tell me what I have to do. But he saw that that moment, he starts seeing the healing coming up.
It's a powerful story you tell, and it just strikes me that you are one of the few musicians we can talk to about what's the source of a song, and you tell me this incredible story about child malnutrition. And let me set up this next question. A song that you wrote about women in war zones and the lack of inclusion in post-war solutions. Was there one particular war in Africa where you saw how women were left out of the process?
All of them. When the South Sudan have his independence, all those women from South Sudan that I met in the refugee camp in Chad, I went there and met them. They talked to me. Their story, till today, impacted my sleep. It took me all those years to live with those horror story of those women to be able to talk about it today. I mean, it was in 2005, and I came back, and my husband didn't know what to do with me because I was just like walking around like a zombie. But one thing that I take from those women that really kept that story alive and empowering for me is that at the end of our meeting, of hours of listening to those horrible stories, they said to us, what we want from you is to go out there and use your power for us to go back to our home in safety and security to be able to put our kids to school and get our life back. Please don't victimize us a second time. We've enough of stigma. We don't want to be seen as victim. We just want to get on onto our life.
It struck me when I saw you perform recently that your show has the same energy and vitality and fun as it always had, but you're also becoming much more of almost a lecturer, and I don't mean that in a bad way, but a teacher, and really bringing your activist chops on stage. What do you think American activists who get involved in Africa don't understand? Because you speak from a position of authority because you're African.
Yeah, the thing is that I learn from the women of Africa all the time when I go back, is sometimes from my mother, is that I learn to listen differently. And words in Africa means a lot. For as a saying in my country that goes, words are like eggs. When they fall, you can pick them back up. So you gotta think twice before you speak. So it demands from anyone that wants to help Africans to hear it from the Africans. The solution, we have it. We might not have the means. If you bring the means, bring your brain with it. Mm. Bring your heart with it. Sit with us. See us as equal to you. We might not speak your language very well, but we live in the reality that you want to help us transform. But how can you transform our reality from afar if we don't tell you what it is, if you don't sit with us to carve a reality that fits our needs that we can live up to when you leave?
Let me ask you a real practical question, final question. You're 53 years old. This is not a secret, public knowledge. And it should be public knowledge because anyone who will see you perform knows that you've got some special secret going on. So
no.
Without telling us a special secret, how much longer can you keep doing this?
I don't know.
I mean, you're out there for 2 hours just putting out just
know,
the most amazing energy.
As long as
energy.
My body can do it, I do it. My age never occurred to me anytime. I woke up in the morning, I just go.
Do you think your activism is fueling your energy in music and maybe vice versa?
I don't know.
No?
It's the energy in the family. I mean, my mom has so much energy. She's 87. We are trying to slow her down. And she's like, leave me alone. You're going to see me. My both grandmother died over 100 years. So I'm here.
You're around for a while.
I'm around for a while.
Singer and activist and author Angélique Kidjo. I couldn't resist asking her to sing for us. And after some hesitation, she finally stepped up to the mic. You don't want to miss the video of Angélique singing in our studio. Check it out at PRI.org. And that's our program for today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org, by the Annenberg Foundation, and by the WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can, and by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.